Thanks, Joan, for such a warm welcome. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. And a big thanks to Hop Farms and my fellow readers. I am going to read from my memoir, Borax Cornmeal and Cherry Blossoms. This is a work in progress, so thanks for letting me try it out on you. Some things you need to know. This is the seventh chapter in my memoir as it currently is. So my memoir is about my mother who suffered from schizophrenia, and it was a very severe case of schizophrenia, a lot of psychotic episodes. My mother's family was from central New York, and her grandparents owned a dairy farm. And I grew up in Indiana, and so this chapter talks about going back and forth between those two places. My brother is Chris. He's mentioned several times. Reliance Electric is where my father worked. And there's a scene about a chicken, which is referred to earlier in the book. And so the language might make you think, I should know what this chicken is about. It works fine, but the reader hopefully would remember it from earlier in the book. So I think that's all you need to know for this. The chapter is called Down the Susquehanna. If you piss in this creek, Dad told Chris, it'll end up in Indiana. In a week or so, someone might be fishing from the banks of the Ohio River and see it go by. I remember this conversation as occurring by the creek on my grandparents' farm in New York. I imagined a yellow slick floating like an inflatable raft over shale creek beds until it reached the Susquehanna. I knew about the Susquehanna from the radio, which had been blaring, "Float your fanny down the Susquehanna" every 10 minutes for the last week, inviting area residents to plop their derrieres into tractor inner tubes and lackadaisically float downriver on a Saturday afternoon. The Susquehanna, I presumed, eventually flowed into the Ohio. I liked the idea that our Indiana and New York lives were connected in this way, especially since New York always seemed so far away. We drove up every year when Dad was off work during Reliance Electric's two-week shutdown. The trip usually took 2 days, bathroom breaks at rest stops and diners, an overnight stay at an interstate motel, though sometimes we would drive through the night to avoid traffic, or set out before dawn and plow straight through. After the lengthy drive, I felt heady and a little disoriented. We were in New York, a whole 750 miles from home. The skies in New York seemed a deeper blue, and the air a little crisper, a little less humid. There was also a shuttle culture shock. Whole milk from Grandpa's cows instead of store-bought 2%, butter instead of mayonnaise on our ham sandwiches, newscasters who pronounced R-O-U-T-E as root instead of route, plus all the run-of-the-mill gossip we heard about people we had never met. Sometimes I was anxious about seeing my relatives again. I knew Mom's immediate family, of course, but how much did I really know them, seeing them only once a year? Still, I loved these trips. That we were connected by water, however tenuously, seemed right. We were not just visitors. We were a part of Mom's family that had simply floated a little farther downstream. Except, the Susquehanna does not flow into the Ohio. It flows south into the Chesapeake Bay, which empties into the Atlantic Ocean. Had we, on our way to New York, stopped along some other creek that does empty into the Ohio? Or was my father mistaken about the ebb and flow of New York's waterways? Either way, my mind wanted some kind of connection, even if my mother's waters ran toward an opposite shore. Over the years, as a pet project, my parents built a cottage just down the hill from Grandpa and Grandma's house. It was rudimentary at first. The particle board floors sagged between the joists if we put too much weight on them. The walls remained unpainted, with putty smeared over the drywall nails. Outside, an electric fence separated the lot from the farm's pastures, next to which stood an outhouse. But every year they made improvements. 1 year they built kitchen counters from 2x4s and plywood. Then they installed a bathtub in anticipation of eventually putting in plumbing. They hauled up mattresses and bed frames from Indiana in the back of Dad's pickup then a couch, and bought a small table and a few chairs at nearby thrift shops. While her parents spent their days working on the cottage, Chris and I entertained ourselves, listening to the radio, drinking cans of black cherry cola, building contraptions out of scrap lumber that resembled race cars and robots, though the wheels were always a problem. Sometimes we would pretend to be archaeologists. The cottage was built on stilts to accommodate uneven terrain, and we would dig in the ground underneath, finding ceramic plate shards from a house that had stood in the same location a generation earlier. A deck off one side overlooked the pastures. Occasionally, our relatives would congregate there to have watermelon in the evenings, a tradition that involved a seed spitting and rind throwing contest. Since the lot was pasture land, we could leave the rinds for the ants, moles, gophers, and crows. Chris once won $1 for throwing a chunk of rind the farthest, and I was very jealous. We stayed in the cottage once it became reasonably habitable, though we still had to haul water and plastic jugs for drinking and dishes, and use the outhouse out back. I hated that outhouse, especially at night. I would shine the flashlight back and forth on the path through the weeds and imagine skunks and possums behind every sharp shadow. Sometimes, even though I wasn't supposed to, I would pee in the bathtub, squatting over the drain pipe that emptied below the house, hoping my parents didn't notice the smell. So that's probably a lot more about me than you ever wanted to know. So moving on. In a photo taken in Indiana the summer of 1980, Chris and I stand in front of a wall of firewood. It's stacked along the backside of a pole barn from ground to eaves, the cross sections of tree limbs forming a mosaic of honey yellow circles and wedges. Chris and I occupy the lower right corner of the frame, with a clump of foxtails in the foreground. The pole barn and firewood take up most of the space. It's as if my father, who took the photo, is saying, "Look at my kids, and the pole barn I built, and all that firewood I chopped this year." My brother and I are the happiest I've ever seen us. I'm 8 and Chris is 5. We're side by side with our arms around each other's shoulders. Chris's chin is jutted forward with just a hint of pride. If I could fold time and briefly insert my adult self in that photo, I'd pull that girl growing out of her shorts and halter top and that boy too small for her shorts and t-shirt into a football-style huddle. "Remember this," I'd whisper. "That's all." I wouldn't tell them that their carefree days would soon be replaced with uncertainty and worry. I wouldn't tell them that their mother's grasp of the perceived world may have already loosened. I wouldn't give any advice for weathering the years ahead, because I have none. There is nothing to do but bear what comes. But having a memory like this, knowing you were once so cared for and loved, helps. Another photo taken the same day shows Chris hugging a chicken. He's standing in front of the chicken coop, wearing two hats, one atop the other, the two brims slightly askew. One of his socks, the tube variety with red stripes at the top, is scrunched around his ankle. The other nearly reaches the hem of his shorts. The chicken must have been the most patient bird on the planet. Chris holds her with both arms wrapped around her chest. One of her reddish-brown wings is slightly raised and tucked into the crook of Chris's elbow. Her feet dangle below his arms in midair. She's looking off to one side as if to say, "Are we done with this foolishness yet?" This is the day that Chris, using heroic child logic, tried to hatch baby chicks by holding a hen, the one in the photo, over a few gathered eggs. I believed it could be done too, and sat reading to him to pass the time. The world made sense to us then, though we may not have understood it entirely. We didn't know we needed a rooster. We didn't know it took weeks to hatch fertilized eggs, not minutes or hours. We surely didn't know what to do with the baby chicks if, miracle upon miracle, they spirited themselves alive, seemingly for our amusement and education. We were, without a doubt, sheltered and naive. We were also pretty oblivious to the world at large, though some things seeped through. Jimmy Carter was president. In Iran, 50-some Americans were being held hostage, which is why yellow ribbons had been tied around the trees near our school. The news often showed uprisings in Soweto, South Africa, and international calls to free Nelson Mandela. Three Mile Island had melted down near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, on the Susquehanna a year earlier. Closer to home, the Marble Hill nuclear power plant was under construction just 10 miles down the road. But the world's troubles seemed, at our young age, distant and mostly irrelevant. Our troubles would be more private and enigmatic. We didn't notice, at first, how the construct of our lives was starting to give way. We didn't know the logical underpinnings of our world would soon come undone. A memory, maybe my first. Nighttime. I'm sitting on the cellar door on the back patio. It's the perfect height for my toddler legs. I look up and see my father standing before me, tall as a tree. He's saying something. He's saying something to me, but I don't understand. Behind him, the moon. It's huge. I don't think it's so very far away. If Dad would just move his head a little, to the left, to the right, I could see better. Maybe even slap my palm against its surface and watch it bounce away. The cellar beneath me is a stone-lined hole. In a few years, I'll watch my father descend an aluminum ladder to the bottom. We don't use the cellar. We keep our potatoes in a kitchen cupboard, and Mom built shelves just inside the patio door for all the vegetables she canned. But the cellar could be used as a bomb shelter, Dad decides. This is the 70s, global nuclear armament, though surely nothing would happen. World leaders would keep everything under control. But what if they didn't? The cellar. That is where we'd go. A few years after that, the cellar is closed off. If World War III happens, the cellar is not going to save us. Instead, my parents add on to the house. Dad's work buddies come over on a hot afternoon and pour concrete where the patio used to be. I am not, under any circumstances, to put my palms print in the wet cement, as tempting as it may be. Mom and Dad soon have the concrete framed with 2x4s. Then comes the insulation and wood paneling. I'm tasked with helping stain the outside and spend a few hours globbing minwax onto the coarse wood fibers with a stiff bristled brush. Chris is helping too. We're making a mess of it, but no one seems to care. Mom and Dad are on ladders with their own cans of minwax, covering a lot more territory than we are. Next comes the greenhouse. It's a problem. So's the skylight. It won't work, Dad says, but Mom insists. They buy boxes of 12 by 12 inch glass panels and aluminum supports. The greenhouse angles down to the ground, forming a triangle on the south side of the new room. The skylight takes about a sixth of the room's roof. Mom installs glass panels with gray caulk. Mom's smart. She's right about a lot of things. But on this one thing, she's wrong. Within a few years, the glass panels start sliding over each other, the gray caulk smeared between them. Another memory. Chris is acting out. He's 8 or 9. He doesn't behave. His teachers say he doesn't pay attention in school. He and I get into fistfights. One day, Mom can't take him anymore. She locks him out of the house. Chris loves Mom very much. Even as a child, I know this. Chris belongs to Mom, while my allegiances are still undecided. Chris wants to come into the house. He knocks and knocks, but Mom won't let him in. He gets a crowbar from the garage and pries open the door. One more memory. The new room, which we now call the greenhouse room, has been finished for a few years. I'm wearing Mom's childhood roller skates, black leather with metal wheels, and zipping across the concrete. The laundry is going. The dryer vents into a closet in the greenhouse room, so we have to leave the closet door open. Mom gets a call. It's her friend Karen. I don't know what they talk about, but Mom takes the phone receiver into the closet and closes the door, the spiral cords stretching from the kitchen. Mom's sobbing. The dryer's going, filling that little closet with heat. I'm still zipping across the concrete. Zip, zip, zip. I knew my mother was changing. She was growing more reclusive, more fearful. But I don't know when she first heard voices. She knew it wasn't normal. She knew to keep it secret. I suspect she heard them for many months, maybe even years. Then my father heard her answering those voices, talking to them in an actual irritated conversations, in an actual irritated conversation. She believed the voices were talking to her through the radio. We were in New York at the cottage. The entire family was circumspect, careful not to reveal anything to Chris and me. But I remember my grandfather and uncle standing on the deck, talking with my mother at the door. They were wearing their farm clothes, my uncle in a white t-shirt, my grandfather in a blue button-down shirt. They talked and talked. They were there to convince her to see a doctor. Okay, she finally said. Once she got back to Indiana, she would go. All right, thank you so much.